Welcome to the Recent Speeches podcast, presented by BYU Speeches, featuring inspiring new devotionals and forums given each week on BYU campus. Be sure to check out our other podcasts by searching BYU Speeches wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting speeches.byu.edu/podcasts.
Good morning, and thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. President of BYU, faculty, the hosts and academics who have invited me to be here, administration, old family who are not here but watching, I hope, and from Africa, and new family, the Smith family who are here in the audience, thank you so much for all your love and support. It feels very much like a homecoming for me being here at BYU. My father-in-law, Scott Smith, taught here for 30 years. I have numerous brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, as well as three nieces who have been students, one of whom is still a student here today. But I should say that it's not just the fact that I'm now affiliated very recently to the Smith family, but also over many decades growing up in Africa, the reputation of BYU is something that has stood out. As was mentioned in the introduction, I was born and raised in Zambia, Southern Africa, one of the poorest countries in the world. Zambia, then known as Northern Rhodesia, was a British colony. Today, the country has 17 million people, and 50% of the population is under the age of 15 years old. Zambia is a copper exporter. Approximately 70% of the earnings that come through foreign exchange are through copper, mainly exported to China. I was born in Zambia, and I was raised as a Presbyterian, and I'm sure you can tell I attended Catholic boarding school. Throughout my life, I did not realize until I was a college student that I did not have a birth certificate. Because at the time of my birth in 1969 in Zambia, birth certificates were not issued to black people. That law changed in 1973. You might be saying to yourself, well, what has that got to do with education, which is the theme of the topic of this devotional and for this period of the semester. And the truth is, it has a lot to do with it. I know, you're asking yourselves, how does a girl from a landlocked part of Africa, a small country, find herself not just speaking at BYU, but married to somebody who was born and raised, or actually just raised, in Provo, right here around the corner? And the truth is, the answer is both complicated and simple at the same time, because the answer is education. Without the education and without the opportunity to get an education, I would not be standing here today. But more generally, my hope this morning is to present you with a whole host of global trends, economic, geopolitical, and social trends that I believe will really dominate and define the global future. But perhaps most importantly, if we're not innovative about addressing the deep structural changes that are occurring around the world, there may not be many more people with the sorts of stories that I've just relayed to you. Stories of how in just 50 years, someone can be born in a country far, far away and not recognized as a human being, but in just 50 years can have the opportunity to get an education and hopefully contribute to the global economy. My presentation today will start off by giving you a quick snapshot about where we are in terms of the global economy. I'll quickly follow on by giving you a bit of a sneak peek into how we are thinking about geopolitical issues around the world. I subsequently will highlight a handful of social challenges and social changes that are defining the world today. And then I would love to spend a bit of time talking to you about some of the deep structural changes that I believe will continue to challenge the global economy going forward. I must confess, in preparing my speech today, it's been a very difficult task. On the one hand, I've had a lot of people say to me, you know what, you're really addressing students. You should be positive and enthusiastic and energetic, which I'd like to think is my general demeanor. But on the other hand, people have said to me, my parents included, not just in the last few days, have said to me, this is BYU, and it's important for us to be honest about the real challenges the global economy is facing today. Not to make us feel sad and despondent, but really as an appeal to BYU's community, but the world in general, that we have to do something together in order to make sure that human progress can continue in a way that is constructive and brings everyone together. I've decided to air and listen to my parents once again, and so parts of what I tell you today might be hard to hear, and it certainly will not be Pollyannish. But I hope that when you leave today, you will not take away a glass half empty approach or thinking, but rather feel that you're more educated with respect to the global challenges that the world faces today. And in that respect, feel much more energized and armed to go out and try and help the world solve these deep structural and seemingly intractable problems. In another way of putting it, is hopefully forewarned is forearmed. So as promised, let me start off by talking to you a little bit about where we are with respect to economics. I start by saying that even before the global pandemic hit in earnest in 2020, we were already in a pretty precarious place. Economically, growth numbers over the previous 10 years have slowed quite considerably. And the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, in 2014 cautioned that on the aftermath of the financial crisis of 2008, we may never again see the rates of economic growth that we saw before 2008. McKinsey, the global consulting firm, made the point that the global growth rates for the next 50 years will be just half the global growth rates that we saw in the preceding 50 years. That's a report that came out by McKinsey in 2015. But in addition, and just to frame this economic growth challenge, which I believe is the defining challenge of our time, in order to double per capita incomes in one generation and meaningfully put a dent in poverty, an economy needs to be growing at 3% a year. As I stand here today, only a handful of countries are growing at that number. In fact, before COVID hit, the majority of developed and developing economies were growing far below that important number. Developed countries like the United Kingdom were growing at 1.4%. Germany posted a GDP number of 0% in Q4 of 2019. Meanwhile, across the emerging markets, the large emerging market economies, which are home to 50 million people, like Brazil, Argentina, Russia, South Africa, many places in Asia, were growing at around 1 to 2%. At stake are people's livelihoods and living standards, but also our ability to be active citizens in the democratic process. And more than that, if we're not able to increase the GDP pie and continue to pursue economic growth, our ability to create jobs, but also to enhance education and healthcare and to solve climate change becomes materially impacted. Now, if I haven't managed to depress you enough, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the political environment. Now, I'm not going to get into U.S. politics or us versus them. I think really what we need to take away are some of the big geopolitical themes that are creating a lot of consternation and concern. So, for instance, Martin Dempsey, who was the head of the Joint Chief of Staffs in the United States, basically has called this period the most dangerous period over his 50-year career. He's partly attributed this to the rise in terrorism around the world, but also the fact that the United States and Western society now has a rival economically and politically in the form of China, whose ideological, economic, and political beliefs are completely different to ours. Our ability to solve the big challenges that we're dealing with around the world means we've got to get across that proverbial divide and the aisle that separates people who have different views and ideological positions. But beyond the issues of ideology, which I'll come to again later, there were other political issues that were quite worrisome. Across many democratic societies, there's been a clear lack of interest with voter participation declining. Here in the United States, low-income households have just a 30% participation rate in the political process. And furthermore, Freedom House, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., has said there's been such a lack of focus on democracy that today 70% of the democracies in the world are illiberal and actually indistinguishable from authoritarian states. They have in mind countries like Venezuela, I imagine, Russia, Zimbabwe, countries that are ostensibly democratic but really are moving away from what we believe to be a liberal democratic state. Let me move on very briefly to the question of social issues and trends that are governing the global economy. Of course, with respect to infrastructure, which is the backbone of economic success, the American Civil Engineers Survey, which comes out once every 3 years, has graded America's infrastructure, roads, railways, airports, bridges, etc., a D+. Now, you might think to yourself, well, what do you care? This is just about America. But it's not. America's success or failure actually defines where the world goes next. And to the extent that you would have a D+ in your infrastructure basically does not bode well for America's economic future prospects, and therefore the prospects for the world. But putting infrastructure to one side, there are now studies, according to the International Rescue Committee, that we are part of or witnessing the fact that we have the highest number of refugees and displaced people ever recorded in history, around 70 million people. And furthermore, it's not just the CDC, but also in a wonderful book called The Drugs Don't Work, before COVID hit, there was a lot of evidence of an increased persistence and arrival of a lot of new communicable diseases and much more resistance to the remedies. So as an economist and as somebody who's very interested in business but also very interested in where public policy goes, we are really in a deep, challenging place. And I'd like to just spend the time that I have left talking to you about some of the specific challenges and the puzzles that economists like myself are spending an enormous time dealing with. I will list them out quickly, and then I'll talk to you about them. And then, of course, I want to remind you that we are not the generation where the world will end. We need to focus on solutions. And so through it all, I will offer you some perspective on how education will be able to help us think more broadly and innovatively to solve some of these challenges. So in no particular order, here are some key headwinds that will make things potentially worse if left unaddressed. One, technology and the risk of a jobless underclass. The fact that technology could displace workers and with more automation could increase what we're calling technical unemployment. Number two, demographic shifts. The quantity and the quality of the world's population is changing in a material way, and in a way that has never been seen before. Number three, income inequality. I say income inequality, but the truth of the matter is we're talking about inequality in general. Inequality in access to public goods like education and healthcare, but also inequality in the ability for people to materially alter their lives. Number four, natural resource scarcity and climate change. What this means in terms of our future. Number five, the sheer amount of debt that the global economy is carrying today, and how that has moved from being a merely economic problem into now being an issue of geopolitics. And finally, number six, productivity. The economists in the room will know that productivity is the most important thing, most important contributor to why some countries grow and others do not. One of the biggest puzzles that we are dealing with right now as economists and public policymakers is why is productivity, the idea of how much each of us contributes to GDP, declining at precisely the time that technology has taken off? Once I've concluded these six items, I will spend a bit of time giving you some solutions and some hope for the future. As I mentioned, I do not believe that this is the generation where we will see the end of society and humanity. And we've seen challenges before. So I urge you through this all to think about this really as an opportunity and a roadmap for education and not really a place for despair. So let's start with technology and the risk of a jobless underclass. At the turn of the last century in 1900, the United States workforce was 60% involved in agriculture, 60%. Today, that number is less than 3%. Less than 3% of Americans are involved in agriculture. And as historians and as economists, we know what happened. Through push and pull factors, Americans moved out of the agriculture sector into manufacturing and out of manufacturing into the service sector. Today, roughly 80% of Americans are involved in the service sector and approximately 18% are involved in manufacturing. The question that we have is that how should we think about the fact that technology is providing robotics and automation that could actually displace human workers and therefore make unemployment a much greater issue. In much the same way that we've seen the diminution of jobs over time, what will happen when we see robotics and automation take over the service sector as well as the manufacturing sector? We have some estimates already. According to the World Economic Forum, 85 million jobs will likely be lost because of automation globally through to 2050. A seminal paper that was written by Oxford Martin School authors in 2013 argued that 47% of jobs in the United States would be lost by 2020. They have subsequently revised those numbers to be a little bit later, but fundamentally, the trend is clear that we will be dealing with the challenge of higher technological or technical unemployment as people lose their jobs. Now, the great British economist John Maynard Keynes in the 1930s had actually forecasted this. He actually suggested that by 2030, we would have a 15-hour work week. And he actually posed the question, what will we do with all that extra time? And he concluded, he hoped that we wouldn't end up in war, but actually that we might contemplate God. Whatever we will be doing, wherever we will be, the fact of the matter is from a public policy perspective, we have to think about what happens when multiple millions of people will likely lose their jobs because of the speed of technological change. The second issue I mentioned was demographic shifts. Today, there are approximately 8 billion people on the planet. According to the United Nations, the world population will continue to grow at a clip until we hit 11 billion people in 2100. India is adding 1 million people a month, 1 million people a month to her population. And the global economy is adding 60 million people a year, which is roughly the size of Britain. As I mentioned to you, my home country of Zambia, a relatively small population of 17 million, has a lot of skew. And it's not uncommon in emerging markets to find that although the populations are relatively small, although they can be larger, the vast majority, or at least half of the population, is under the age of 15. We have got to provide jobs and opportunities for that group of people. And today, 90% of the world's population lives in the emerging markets. Now, you might think to yourself, well, that's an Africa problem, or it's a Zambia problem, or it's a problem of the emerging markets. But it is not. It will be a problem in your backyard through disorderly migration, a very difficult thing to do, to have to move and leave your home and family and friends and context to move elsewhere because you're forced due to economic and political changes. But that might be the world that we're heading for if we cannot manage the demographics. I'd like to put the demographic shift in context. In 1960, a Time magazine cover heralded the fact that there were 3 billion people on the planet. From 1960 to where we are today, just around 60 years, we've managed to multiply increase the world's population. It took 125 years to go from 1 billion people to 2 billion people. It has taken us 60 years to go from a mere 3 billion people to 8 billion people today. We expect the world population to keep growing at a clip. In places like my home country, it's growing rapidly. And we have to do something about managing the population growth, but at the same time thinking very clearly about what opportunities we can deliver for young people as they sort of come online. It's not just the quantity of the world's population that's challenging, it's the quality of the world's workforce. According to the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, a study that they put out not too long ago, this generation of Americans, for the first time in the history of this country since 1776, will be less educated than the preceding generation. A survey of mathematics, science, and reading that comes out every 3 to 5 years by the OECD, called the PISA study, the Program for International Student Assessment, has concluded that the United States, which used to be the number one, number two, number three in these subjects, mathematics and science, etc., is now in the bottom ranks, number 27 and 28 and 29. This is simply not good enough. It's not good enough for the United States, and it's not good enough for the rest of the world. As you can see, even in this live experiment that we've just witnessed with the development of the vaccine, the world is heavily depending on the United States to get it right. So we've got to actually make sure we invest in education. We also have to think about the deep concern that was highlighted most clearly in a McKinsey report a number of years ago, that the underinvestment in education of Blacks and Latinos in the United States is so damaging that it could put the United States in a permanent economic recession by 2050. At a time when there's a massive pushback against immigration, you have to think very strategically about how an economy like the United States can possibly think that it can function and compete longer term when we're underinvesting in its own citizens. I'll now move on to the area of income inequality. When I was doing my PhD at Oxford, nobody talked about income inequality. We assumed that if we created economic growth, This would help us all be uplifted in terms of economic success, and in fact, we would be able to move from one economic class to another economic class, the so-called American dream. But have a look at the data today. The probability of being born in a low economic class and ending your life in a high economic class, what we term social mobility, has gone down by 50% in the United States over the last several decades. Social mobility is the backbone of solving the income inequality problem. And it's very inextricably linked to the education problem that I highlighted a moment ago, that people cannot get out of their rut and hope to succeed in the issue of inequality if they don't have the opportunities to progress. But the income inequality challenge and the inequality challenge goes beyond American borders. According to Oxfam, one of the largest charities globally, the 8 wealthiest men, and they're all men, have more wealth than the bottom 50% in the world today. So 8 versus about 3.5 billion people. What are we going to do about it? Well, the truth is we need new ideas. Because as economists, we have tried the extremes. We have adopted tax and redistribution policies, if you look around places like Europe, and unfortunately that has not helped to stem the tide. We've also looked at more what I'd call right-leaning, supply-side approaches, approaches where we thought about keeping the tax rate low in the hope of encouraging investment and job creation. But that has also not helped solve the problem of inequality. To make matters worse, the number one and number two largest economies in the world today, the United States and China, have two completely different political approaches and two completely different economic approaches, but they both have the same Gini coefficient, roughly the same Gini coefficient, which is a measure of income inequality. The United States, as you know, democratic society, believer in liberal democracy, and also very much about market capitalism, is still the number one economy, but China is very aggressively the number two economy and has deprioritized democracy and has adopted a more state capitalist approach to its economics. These two economies, completely different in their ideological pursuits, have the same or roughly the same Gini coefficient at around 0.43. As was mentioned in the introduction, I've been very fortunate to be able to travel to many countries, over 70 countries, developed and developing, rich and poor. And the fact of the matter is one of the most popular questions that I get, especially in developing countries, poor economies, what model should we pursue in order to make sure we don't have such a wide gulf in inequality? Should we pursue the Western model the United States adheres to, or the Chinese model? And this is one of the big challenges we have to deal with continually. The next area I wanted to touch on was on the area of climate change and particularly natural resource scarcity. In terms of natural resource scarcity, I've been very privileged to be part of a small group of 20, basically a number of economists and former policymakers and Nobel laureates, who have an audience with the Chinese president every couple of years. President Xi Jinping, a few years ago, was asked in this private room, in this gathering, what kept him up at night? What was the worst thing that he worried about and the most important thing that he was concerned about? And in that meeting, President Xi Jinping said it was natural resource scarcity. That somehow over time we have convinced the world's population that they can all live at the living standards of the average American. And yet we were facing a decline in natural resources, arable land, potable water, energy, and minerals. So that demand, because of growing populations and urbanization and just the sheer improvement in living standards in the emerging market would not be matched by the natural resource scarcity challenges that I just mentioned. But quickly moving on to that fundamental challenge, because some of you will probably be thinking to yourself, we've heard this before. 1700s, Malthus had mentioned that there would be natural resource scarcity because of population growth. We had that same concern in the 1970s when the Club of Rome also said we should be worried about natural resource scarcity. And of course, more recently, peak oil theories are people's concern about the diminution and the decline of natural resources and how we'll be able to feed and support our world's population. But the truth of the matter is we've looked at those problems and we've been bailed out by technology. So there's a great hope that technology could do that again. But at the same time, we are confronting the issue of climate change. Now, the truth is about climate change, I think I would say I'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who doesn't at least say, you know what, I think we might have questions about the timing, we might have questions about the extent, but fundamentally, we largely, by and large, agree that there's something going on with humans creating or contributing to the heating of the Earth. I come from a region of the world where there are millions of people who do not have access to energy in a cost-effective and reliable way. In fact, according to estimates, 1.5 billion people around the world do not have energy in a way that they can sustain themselves, certainly not in a world of Zoom calls that we've become so reliant on. I had the privilege of taking some of my new Smith family to Zambia with me, and also to South Africa, which is a middle-income country, and they saw firsthand the challenges of brownouts or the reduction or the shutting down of energy. In order to combat climate change, we can't leave those people behind. This goes back to the opportunity for education and to transform people's lives over a period of time in a way that's meaningful and to pursue human progress. We simply will not be able to do that without bringing everybody to the table to help address climate change. I can assure you, as somebody who serves on the board of a large energy company, we're doing everything in our capacity. We're investing in renewables like solar and wind and biothermal and geothermal, and biomass, as well as areas of nuclear generation 4 and a whole host of other new efforts to make sure that we can satiate the global demand for energy. But this is not a problem that's going away anytime soon, and we need new ideas and new innovation. I'll move on to the last two items very quickly. One is debt, and the other is productivity. Now, debt is an interesting one, because before we had COVID, again, 2020, every class of debt in the United States, government debt, household debt, corporate debt, credit card debt, auto loan debt, and student loans were all each $1 trillion separately for each class. This is unsustainable, especially in an era of slow, low, and no economic growth. Today, 14% of American companies are what are called zombie companies, companies whose cash flows are not enough to cover just the interest payment on the debt that they owe. But as I mentioned to you in my preamble, the problem of debt has moved from just being an economic one into now a geopolitical one. China is the largest foreign lender to the American government. And these issues around debt, which have been exacerbated in the back of COVID, mean we have to come to the table with people and countries that perhaps we would not think about engaging with in years past. China today is not only the largest trading partner, foreign direct investor, as well as engaged partner from a political perspective for many developed and developing countries, but with respect to debt, China is now the largest lender to emerging market countries bigger than the World Bank, bigger than the IMF, and bigger than the Paris Club. If we want to move on and figure out a future post-debt, which today is over 300% debt-to-GDP ratios, we have got to come to the table and engage. I should also just point out really quickly that with respect to debt, the problem with it, if you cannot pay it off, is that you're forced into corners where you might have to default. And I can assure you that that is not a place that we want to find ourselves. Productivity, I'll touch on as I run out of time here, very quickly. It's 60% of why one country grows and another one does not. The other two key aspects of economic growth are capital and labor, which we've talked about, demographics and capital in terms of debt. But productivity is declining. The ability for each of us to contribute to GDP is declining at precisely the time that we think it should be increasing. This is a puzzle that's been going on for a decade, primarily in developed economies. There are a lot of theories about why that might be the case. I've written about this extensively myself. But the fact of the matter is we have to solve this problem in order to jumpstart and increase economic growth and therefore solve the whole host of problems that I've just outlined for you today. I'm coming to the end of my time here, but I'd like to leave you with some constructive ways to think about moving forward and staying positive. Now, the truth is we're probably not going to be ever going to be the greatest generation. I think we can safely say that there was a greatest generation, but we can try very hard to be the second greatest generation. And that's going to require us to be very much more open-minded, less ideological, for government to be much more efficient in much of the same way that government in this country actually helps to build the interstate road network. Government helped to build Silicon Valley, the Manhattan Project, and a whole slew of other initiatives where government worked in partnership with the private sector. We're simply not going to be able to solve these problems without efficient and effective government. But we also need to become much more aware of the trends that are going to define and really drive the world going forward. China is not going away. We have to engage. We cannot leave them out there to become a big rival. We have to engage. Technology, lots of scope for technology to move away from just being about social networks and, you know, basically consumerism, but really being a tool for solving public good problems like education and healthcare. And then, of course, there's an era, we're in the era of a green revolution. Our ability to think in a very smart and innovative way of how to, on one hand, solve the very urgent challenge of natural resource scarcity and climate change, but at the same time bring along the billions of people who are out there suffering under the weight of the decisions that we make every day. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm out of time, but I'm delighted for the opportunity to share with you a menu of opportunities for us to engage and get energized about how we can contribute to the world. And most importantly, how we're going to have to become less ideological and much more engaged in the societies in which we live. Thank you very much for your attention and opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Moyo, thank you for your address. My name is George Garcia. I'm studying economics and math. Planning to get a PhD in economics here in the not too far future. I've been trying to figure out how to formulate this question, so bear with me here. Many people within the effective altruism movement, a movement that has arisen largely out of your alma mater of Oxford, have promoted
I'm sorry, can I just ask you to slow down just a little bit?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I just had my 52nd birthday, so my hearing's not that good.
Yeah, thank you. Many people within the effective altruism movement, a movement that has arisen primarily out of your alma mater, Oxford, have promoted the long-termist paradigm, which posits that we should focus on doing good over the very long term. But it is well known that democracies have a strong bias towards the present, focusing more on the short-term welfare of its citizens, at times to the detriment of the well-being of future generations. We see this primarily with climate change now. My first question, supposing that this long-termist paradigm is valid, how do we promote a long-termist paradigm or intergenerational equity in democracies, specifically, are the indices that you talked about right now, GDP, the Gini index, education levels, are they the correct indices for us to be focusing on if we want to promote long-term welfare and not short-term welfare?
Thank you so much for that question. I don't know if people heard it, but just to give you a quick summary, I think the question was about the fact that we have a lot of long-term challenges and whether or not democracy was in some sense ineffective in solving these problems because we have so many regular elections. And I think most specifically are interested in how we might think about closing that gap between the long-term problems and the short-term issues. Is that a good summary?
That's absolutely right.
Okay, super. So what I would suggest, I think that that is a critical question for all the problems that I laid out earlier, because they are all long-term intergenerational problems. Something like education is something that you plant the kernels of success today by sending a child to nursery school or kindergarten, but really society benefits longer term in two or so generations and sometimes longer. I've actually written extensively on specific things that we can do to actually close that gap of the short-term thinking of government versus the long-term challenges that we're dealing with. And some of the examples that I think have worked in an interesting way and we ought to explore objectively are, for example, what is done in Singapore, where public policymakers are paid based on outcomes. And funny enough, this is how things work in the private sector as well. We look at compensation. We more and more are compensating CEOs for long-term performance, not just quarterly share price movements. And in Singapore, what they've done is that they have now attached a bonus to ministers who are responsible for different areas like education or healthcare. And so if you come to the end of the year and Minister X, responsible for healthcare, has actually improved the life expectancy of Singaporeans or has reduced infant mortality, they get a bonus. And more than that, there's malus and what they call malus and clawback, so that in 5 or 10 or 15 years' time, if it turns out that the minister was fiddling with the numbers or was actually not doing what they claimed they were doing, there's a way for society to claw back on their pensions. And I think that's that kind of innovative thinking we should be exploring. Our policymakers should not be allowed to make policy decisions that are in the short term beneficial to win elections, but perhaps longer term can be quite damaging. Another very quick example of things that are happening, and this happens a lot in Europe, is actually forcing or increasing the length of a political office. The United States, to my mind, having elections every 2 years, given the swathe of challenges that we're facing that are long-term, is too regular. You know, places like Mexico, across the European continent, have longer terms. Sometimes they say you only have one term. In Brazil, if you're a senator, you get one term, but it's for 9 years. And that's better matched to the business cycles that we see where an economy ebbs and flows over time. I'm not going to sort of push my own product here, but in my book, Edge of Chaos, I do outline 10 proposals for how we might improve democracy, and they're not suggestions that were cooked up in my kitchen. They are actual real-life, real solutions to short-termism that are being applied in different countries where we might be able to learn to solve this problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Moyo, how are you? My name is Eddie, and I'm studying marketing. I have two questions for you, two very important questions. One, do you eat ice cream? And if so, what is your favorite flavor? And my second question, it relates to new ideas and new innovations. Those were two words that you said a lot during your talk. And I would like to know, if you were a student here at Brigham Young University, with the experience of economics and just the life experience that you've had, where would you focus? And how would you propagate new ideas and new innovation for the future?
So thank you, Eddie, for those two questions. Absolutely. Who hates ice cream? I'd like to meet this person. I love ice cream. My favorite flavor is very boring vanilla. But the truth is I'll eat strawberry and chocolate as well if you have it on offer. But with respect to your other question around innovation, I think the most important thing and my husband and I talk a lot about this, is the issue of continuous learning. I think rightly or wrongly, as young people, there comes a point where you think you know everything. And I was victim of this myself, and I've been victim of this. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of the challenges the world faces are complicated challenges. So rather than point fingers and say, well, those guys do this and we're different, think about why it is people have a different perspective than yours. I know this is highly unpopular in an era of cancel culture, but I do think with respect to science and technology and real innovation and ideas and our real fundamental ability to come up with solutions and address the challenges, the common challenges that we're all facing, it's going to require thinking about what other people or how other people think about the same problems. So I would suggest that you look at the books that you read, the people you spend time with, and the opportunities that you take, and force yourself to think about, or one should ought to force themselves to think about learning different cultures, different ways of thinking. We're living in a world where that is not such a crazy idea. As I outlined, the U.S. and China, they're both successful. But how is that possible, that they can both be economically successful but have such different models? Let's try and investigate, what are they doing that we might learn from, and what are we doing that they could learn from? And so I try very hard to be open-minded and not ideological, as I mentioned. I think that's what's the best way forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again so much for coming, Dr. Moyo. My name is Taylor Munlin. I'm studying History and Africana Studies here at BYU. I'm also president of the Black Student Union. I was very touched by what you said about needing to invest in Black and Brown communities and the education for students in K-12. As someone who came from a school district that was redlined, meaning they had put all the Black and Brown kids in one part by like different houses and gave us the shorter end of the stick with resources and everything, and a first generation college student, I want to know what we might be able to do, or what you feel might be possible for us as a Black Student Union to help invest in the Black and Brown communities right now.
So I think that's a wonderful question, and I think the good news, I hope, is that that is not a question only for Black and Brown people. I think in order for the world to succeed, more and more people, I believe, recognize that as a problem that we all have to address. The good news is I think there are many people with good intentions and good motivations. Again, you know, right now my husband is reading the biography Titan of John D. Rockefeller. I mean, the truth of the matter is I did not know that he actually named Spelman College, which for people who don't know is one of the leading historically Black colleges in this country. It's an all-female college, but he named it after his parents-in-law, the Spelmans, but he basically was deeply concerned about the plight of Black people in the United States. And it's tragic that in some sense we have not moved further along as we should have, but I would urge you to be optimistic, because I do think whether it's corporations, government, private individuals, and broader society, I think there's a real moment here where there's a recognition that this is not just about the failure of Black and Brown communities, it's about broader economic and social success of the United States. I think a lot of Americans felt shame, and doesn't matter what their race or age or backgrounds were, to see what happened to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, who just, you know, as somebody who loves running, it's deeply touching to see what's happened there. But I would not use these horrendous experiences as a way to become much more insular. I would take them as an opportunity to really engage across our backgrounds and race and genders even to become much more optimistic and engaged. I think this is a moment, and I think that there is a lot of goodwill beyond just handing out scholarships, which is critically important because of education. There's real momentum around providing opportunities for companies, for organizations, suppliers, et cetera. And as somebody who's very deeply involved right now in a race commission looking at education and healthcare, as well as criminal justice reform and employment. I think there's a real need and a real urgency. So we should basically come up with ideas so that people aren't veering in the wrong direction, but also to make sure that people don't feel bad about it. I think that we have to be careful that we don't alienate our fellow citizens, because and that they don't think that there's a common need for their participation. So I hopefully, I think things will change. I'm very optimistic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Madison Earnshaw. I'm studying Middle Eastern Studies, Arabic, and Economics. And in your talk, you mentioned kind of the troubling trend of reduced voter turnout. And in your book, Educate Us, you also mentioned how in other countries they have compulsive voting, so they get much higher voter rate participations. My question is, are there quantifiable economic impacts of increasing voter turnout, or like evidence that countries with higher voter turnout have more effective governments?
Yes, there are. And again, I hate to thank you for reading my book. Actually, in the book, I do cite a couple of studies. Australia is a very good example of what you've just asked. There are many countries, about 20 countries around the world, in Europe, in South America, Australia being another example, of countries that have imposed compulsory rules for voting. And as you pointed out, they basically they encourage it not only by insisting that you have to vote, but they will penalize you if you don't show up to vote. So you will have no access to public health care or public education. So there's some incentives, but there's also a much more aggressive penal approach. And the truth is the participation rates in voting in those countries is closer to 99%. And you're absolutely, to your specific question, are there consequences that have been identified and evaluated? As I said, Australia is a very good example of that. They have seen, they've done test cases where there have been changes in policies because they used to have a much more sort of less compulsory, less mandatory requirements around voting. And they can see that in terms of what voters want and how money is earmarked and invested in capitals allocated is changed materially in those two environments. But also you get much more voter engagement, less tolerant of lack of inefficient policymakers, and a lot of it is very well calibrated. Australia, to me, is the best example to give you sort of quantitative numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your address, Dr. Moyo. My name is Elizabeth Wallace, and I study comparative literature. My question has to do with your takeaway that we should be less ideological and more engaged. And I wondered if you could give an example for a student who's just about to graduate and enter the world, so to speak, of how one can be less ideological and more engaged.
Yes. So I think, first of all, I should have made the point, and I'm sorry people have left because I would have loved them to hear, that being less ideological doesn't mean having no values. I think that's really important, that we have a moral compass and we have values. And I think if we really ascribe to those values, we would find we were less on the, I think, on the wrong side of society more generally. But to your specific question around examples, for me, there's not a single public policy question that is easy or is obvious. And I think that's probably why I like board work, because even things that might seem obvious are never obvious. And I think having that approach to big public policy questions, but to life in general, that things are not as obvious as you might think they are, I think is incredibly helpful. And if I can give you one specific example, which I touched on already, is the question of climate change. So, as I mentioned to you, I don't think I know anybody who would say it's completely nonsense and doesn't have any merit. We can quibble about the extent and how soon it might happen, but fundamentally people agree, hey, yes, we are society, humans are contributing to climate change. But look at how that discussion has evolved. We're now at each other's throats. There are people who are campaigning to defund energy companies at a time when 1.5 billion people have no access to energy. Is there an opportunity to be less dogmatic about the need for urgency so that we can have everybody, the people who work in energy companies, to come to the table and help us think about what actually is viable in a scalable way? So that's just one example. Income inequality is another example. There are people, I'm sure, in this room who doggedly believe we should tax the rich and we should hand it out as redistribution. And there are other people who think we shouldn't. And neither of us are right, and essentially we're both wrong because we've seen what the long-term implications of those both of those type of policies are. But rather than end up in one corner or another, are there sorts of policies that are in between that maybe focus on education and solving the social mobility problem rather than thinking about short-term solutions about taxes and interest rates in the immediate term? I could go on and on. There's so many of these issues. I don't want to sound like I'm marketing, but in my next book, I'm looking at, from a board perspective, things like pay equity, gender equity, worker advocacy. I mentioned environmental concerns. Data privacy is another one. I'll just leave you with this thought, and then I'll take I don't want to eat into too much time. We all like our data to be ours. It's private. But at the same time, we want to be able to get a solution for cancer. We want a remedy for COVID as soon as possible. Are there trade-offs that we are willing to give up? How should we think about that? If you are on the board of Johnson & Johnson or Merck, or one of the large pharmaceutical companies, should they open an office in China and then have access to bigger data sets because the Chinese lens or approach to data privacy is different, which we could benefit from? If Merck or Pfizer comes up with a cure for cancer, we'll all benefit from that. Are we willing to give up part of our privacy for that? There are lots of these public policy questions that don't have an answer, and I think the attitude around, maybe humility is the word, that we don't have an answer. And if there were an answer, I'd love to quote President Obama. He always said, by the time something hits our desk, if it were easy, it would have been solved a long time ago. The fact that it hasn't been solved means it's extremely difficult. And that's my approach to the world. I don't think we can't solve these problems, but let's just take a little bit more humility in solving them, whether it's aid to Africa or data privacy or natural resource scarcity and environmental concerns.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Alex McBride. I'm studying computer engineering and Portuguese.
And I'm sure I can hear your question because you think you're the only person who's shown up without a mask. I'm grateful for that because I'm struggling to hear. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I have a passion for economics. I love reading the new ideas and the new research that comes out pretty much every day. And one of my concerns is that I don't really see us changing. Public policies stay the same, even though we have all of these great ideas for how to make the world better. So my question is, how can we make those ideas into policy, and how can I, as an engaged citizen, help in that effort?
Yeah, so you've reminded me of a French phrase, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Things change, but everything's the same. And I, over this past year, I've spent a lot of time looking back in history to say, well, have there been times when we've come from a period of huge economic success and globalization and large corporations really helping to grow an economy, and then somehow ended up in a period where we've had a financial crisis, we've had a pandemic? And the truth is, yes, we have. The Gilded Age, 1870 to 1900 in the United States, a period of amazing wealth, immense economic success, lots of globalization. Just as a quick sidebar data point, which I thought was interesting, 14% of Americans are foreign born. 14%. And if you look back at the Gilded Age, 14% of Americans at that time were foreign-born. But because of public policy, that number dipped down to around 6% in the 1960s. So, you know, one of the arguments that I've been making recently is that we could be going back into a period of real economic challenge, which is similar to what we saw in the 1930s. You know, with FDR and much more progressive economics, which was obviously in response to the Gilded Age, but also the Spanish flu, which killed 50 million people, the financial crisis of that time, stock market and depression, plus the World War I. So I worry that there is this concern around history repeating itself. And, you know, if you ask me what should you do, what I think is most important is really going back in history. You know, I think we don't spend enough time appreciating what was learned in past eras. There's a wonderful book by John Barry called The Great Influenza. It is a deep treaty, a deep analysis, and John Barry is still alive, wonderful book about what worked during the Spanish flu. You know, I think we've seen a lot of people who we would call the sort of superstar celebrities of COVID, but I've barely seen John Barry out there. But he's got a historical context that I think would be immeasurable about the efficacy of masks, the importance of social distancing, a whole lot of things. And some of the things will actually surprise you and surprise us. So in a nutshell, go back into the annals of history, not just to the 1870s, which, by the way, I mean, I don't know if you knew this, but between 1850 and 1900, every single American president had one term in office. I mean, in terms of consecutive terms. But there's just a wealth of knowledge and understanding, not just about the United States, but countries like China. China was the largest economy in the 1700s, the largest economy in the world. What did they do wrong for them to end up one of the poorest countries in the world? History can tell us that. And so that's where I think, if I look back on my own education, I feel like it was a little bit shortchanged. Thanks, Mom and Dad. I think that I should have done a lot more history because there's something to look back and learn what people did. And not only as a way of checking what we can learn, but I think even more importantly, to have that humility that I mentioned about what is actually possible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Moyo,
Hi.
For your words and your time.
Thank you.
My name is Liam Dalton. I'm an international relations student. My question is more of a political type question. In a lot of the courses that I've taken, they've emphasized the increasing chance of governments turning into a populist type government. I reference here France, I reference Turkey, Hungary, and Austria. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on how we as a democracy, as well as the incoming workforce, how can we prevent populism from gaining a stronghold and from becoming part of our government?
Wow, that's a big one. That's a book. So I think a lot about that question in the context of comparing a society like the United States, which prioritizes individual rights, versus a political environment such as China, which prioritizes society. The sort of shorthand is that in China, there's a view that human beings aren't to be trusted. Individuals are very self-centered. They do things and make choices that are not just damaging for themselves, knowingly. So, you know, my love for ice cream, I probably eat too much ice cream. I know it's not good for me, but I still do that. We do those sorts of things without due consideration for what it's going to do for society. And the reason I bring that up as an answer to your question is because I think that the more there's a more active discussion around the costs and consequences of our individual behaviors and choices, which, by the way, economics, in Western economics, as I was taught, is not good at ascribing those costs, the more that there's a discussion around that, I think the better and more refined our public policy choices will be. And I think that will also lead to less populism. I think part of the reason you end up with populism, and I do think this COVID experience has been a wonderful laboratory for this exact question, is that we've convinced people that their individual rights and freedoms are costless, and that they are entitled to that. And this goes back to ideology, and I should be very clear, I actually love living in the United States, I love my freedoms, but I think we need to be much more conscious about what the costs and consequences of even small decisions are for the rest of the world and the rest of society. Who is going to pay for those costs? How will society pay for those costs? And sitting in a world of a pandemic where we think about how our neighbors not getting vaccinated or not wearing a mask, what that might mean for us, I think all of these are live questions, live to your point about the risks of populism, and more fundamentally, what levers government has to step in when basically things like pandemics happen, which I'm afraid to say I think are likely to happen again. So it's in that fundamental question that we have to think about what we're willing to give up in Western society, and are we going to be forced to give it up, as I was saying earlier, in terms of sugar taxes or some other challenges, sometimes punitive, but also some incentives to try and change our behaviors that might be on the table.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This will be our last question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Moyo, for your
Thank
time
you.
Today.
Thank you.
My name is Adam Nissen, and I am studying economics here at BYU. You gave us an overview of the looming problem of job loss in the United States and abroad due to automation and the lack of need for unskilled workers. I was wondering what sector you imagined this large group of unskilled, potentially unemployed workers moving into, or if you entertained the idea of an era of prosperity in which there was a society designed to support a large group of unemployed workers.
So I think there are two questions there. I think they're both critically important. With respect to what sector comes next, I think it's a brilliant question, because I would say, because I've grown up in finance and I've grown up in public policy, I tend to think of things as glass half empty. How are we going to move every citizen forward? But I've also spent a lot of time in tech space, including with my husband, who's a tech person. And I very often get the refrain, oh, don't worry, just because we don't know what the answer is doesn't mean it's not coming. Just stick with it. It's going to be a solution. I think a lot of technology people would say something in the R&D space, something in the science space, which is why STEM is so important, will be the backbone of changing jobs, changing opportunities. There are more fundamental questions about whether or not we all need to work as much as we have worked. In other words, can we live in a society where we actually, instead of measuring GDP, which as a measure of success, we start to measure time saved as a way of a measure of success. So rather than be an African woman who has to carry for miles a barrel of water on my head, the fact that I can turn on the tap has saved me time. That is human progress. And so we might need a fundamental shift as how we think about the value of human progress and how we estimate that. And there's a lot of discussion on that in living standards and wellness, and President Sarkozy in France, the Prime Minister in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, they're actually implementing this type of frame of thinking, that GDP and numbers that look only at sort of technological gains in science and replacement coming from another sector, from R&D, might not be the way we should think about progress. We should start thinking about progress in the sense of time saved. It's an interesting concept. I would just say, from a public policy perspective, the issue is not that we couldn't land in a different place where we're actually, instead of working 40 hours a week, we're working 15 hours a week, as Maynard Keynes said. But the problem is, how do we transition to that? To get from here to there, for people working 40 hours a week, to tell people, actually, you don't need to work 40 hours a week, how do you transition to that place, which may be a utopia, without really materially influencing people's lives in a negative way? I wrote my first book really touching on that. Handing out cash is not a solution, because it might seem like a solution, but there's aspects of it that are very degrading to humans and to people who want to contribute in terms of their abilities into society. So that's how I would think about it. The sector is probably something in R&D and sciences. How should we be thinking about that? So it's really reassessing the value of human progress, how we calculate and calibrate that, and that's already underway in these countries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes our question and answer session. Let's give a round of applause to Dr. Moyo again. Thank you for coming today.
You've been listening to the Recent Speeches podcast presented by BYU Speeches. Please check out our other podcasts, including classic speeches taken from our vast audio library, as well as other BYU Speeches compilations on love and marriage, overcoming adversity, by study and by faith, Come Follow Me, the Prophet Joseph Smith, and Jesus Christ, our Savior and Redeemer. Go to speeches.byu.edu and click on podcasts for more information. You can also find all BYU Speeches podcasts at your preferred podcast provider.